Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 112, where Miranda, Rohan, Pedro, and Tom are discussing a 1969 book from Lawrence J. Peter and Raymond Hill titled The Peter Principle, published by Buccaneer Books. In part two, we consider the legacy of the book and how this work of satire ventured into more traditional scholarship. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So I wanted to point out another ethos that is implicit in this book. In part one, we talked about the broader kind of, for lack of a better term, call it the capitalistic ethos, where what you want is to rise as far as you can or to keep progressing, keep getting promoted in this hierarchy. And that's almost a value judgment. Another ethos that comes up in the middle part of the book is when the authors start to talk about what you can do to reach your level of incompetence and how you can get promoted. And that is one of, playing the game, for, again, lack of a better phrase, where the idea is that you need to have this level of almost cynicism where you want to just get to the top regardless of caring intrinsically, about the work or about the impact of your work on customers or something like that. And in that sense, this book reminded me somewhat of the famous kind of Jeff Pfeffer book on power and how to get that in organizations. Because here in, this is, I think, in the chapter on push and promotion, and on my edition, it's page 49. But the author says the subsection is a dangerous delusion. And so this chapter is talking about how people think that promotions are based on push, i.e. the input that I put in, the effort that I put in, versus pull, which is someone above me pulling me up because of influence, because of networking, because of what he calls patronage. But the delusion is, and I quote, "the obsessive feeling that a person who pushes harder than average deserves to advance farther and faster than average." So this idea of deserving more because you're just pushing more, you're doing more work, you're putting more hours in, is what they call a danger. He calls it a moralistic delusion. In the Jeffrey Pfeffer book, they call it a just world hypothesis, the belief that I reap what I sow, essentially. And so I need to sow more if I want to reap more. And similarly, there was a book a few years ago by the kind of Harvard moral philosopher Michael Sandel called The Myth of Meritocracy. So that's, the myth that what you put in is strongly correlated with what you get out. And what's common across all of this, whether it's Michael Sandel's Myth of Meritocracy, Jeffrey Pfeffer's Power Book, or The Peter Principle, is that that's not how the world works. And so it's just kind of a cynical take of there's a loose correlation. I think the Pfeffer book talks about a potential, even negative correlation between input and stuff like outcomes like promotion. And hence, the tactics that you follow are such and such. And in the case of this book, they talk about having patrons, having multiple patrons, because you can't rely on just one. Then somewhere they say a patron without no motivation is no patron at all, because again, you need the patron to also, there has to be something in it for them. I remember kind of behind the scenes, someone telling me this again in a cynical way about tenure in academia, where in the top schools, at least, where it's a bit more intangible what leads to tenure, the suggestion was you just need people in there for whom, rather you need to think, what do they gain from giving me tenure? What's in it for them? How is this a win for them, not for me? And this book talks exactly about that in the pull and promotion sense, which is, it's not just about having patrons, but your patrons having skin in the game that they get something by helping you move up the ranks.
So this talk about ethos, more in the actual book maybe, made me think of bureaucracy and Weber, right? Because I feel that some of the ethos that is implicit towards the end, right, because they do all of this sort of what it would do, and that is the mechanics and push and pull, and that's how patronage work, right? Almost I felt to just diagnose it clearly, But then the message, I felt, was much more about trying to stay true to one's attachment to the role, right? Which is a traditional bureaucratic Weberian thing about, you know, treasuring the sphere of obligation that you have, and of course the foundation idea that your competence is also aligned with your sphere of obligation, right? And indeed, the word competence is used by Weber, and, you know, has even in English, as this means both things, a sphere of competence, right? But also one's ability, an area of ability and skills that someone has. And, you know, in the famous essays about vocation, there is this whole idea that in academia and beyond, you know, you may see people getting ahead for a variety of reasons, but the point is to sort of cultivate one's ethos that transcends that, that values the work, right? That's one of my potential readings. Of course, one can read Weber and all of this debate in so many ways, which I found is interesting, right? It's a kind of, it's a counter to the many pathologies that are so common to all types of organizations that are described in the book, from the means and the placement we talked about, that is, people, you know, intend to value what is the means but not the actual goal that the organization is trying to achieve, to the ones that one values obedience as a value in itself, right? Because that's a way through which you also get ahead, because the people in the hierarchy value the hierarchy, value the obedience, so not exactly the actual work, right? These are all pathologies typical for organizations, including bureaucratic ones. But I felt that there is also an implicit praise for this ethos in which one, that it's about putting the work front and center, or trying to do that in such a world, in such a context that pushes you away from that.
Yeah, and what I was thinking in as I'm listening you talk about, you know, he ends the push chapter, by the way, with never push when you can pull, taking him at his word in this particular case, despite the satire, saying that it is always better to be pulled, to be brought up by someone else. And the thing that I was thinking about, what we talked about in part one, about the difficulties of achieving a higher status and finding yourself out of your element. One of the challenges of achieving that status is the realization that it isn't just the work that changes, but it's also, there's so many things as a manager that you have to contribute to allow the bureaucracy to run, okay? To turn the crank of the bureaucratic machine so that those below or in the line, shall we say, can do their work uninterrupted. And a lot of that managerial crank turning is invisible, and it's designed to be invisible. I mean, it's a background type of work that you know, the management would rather nobody knew about, because it's ugly, it's sausage making, it's very difficult. In that regard, I could see the real value, not in terms of thinking somewhat cynically about the supervisor as a, you know, pulling people up for transactional purposes, but the supervisor serving as a mentor to a protege who seems to have some sort of, you know, series of it factors that I can pull up and say that, okay, you seem to have potential. Whether or not you're the best performer, you seem to have potential. And you seem to be one who could adapt to this other weird environment where the invisible work over here of running the bureaucracy is now visible to you. And it's the type of thing that grinds people to a halt. And so then pull becomes very much a positive, the challenge being that, of course, you can only pull so many. And the risk of pulling the wrong person up to their immediate level of incompetence is so great, because it not only means you pulled somebody up who's awful, but also somebody who doesn't have the ability to keep running this bureaucracy to absorb this invisible work. It sort of highlights that there's a real benefit to this way of thinking from the managerial standpoint. If you're looking down and in for your pool of prospective fellow managers or next generation of managers. Nowadays, since we're talking about so much more mobility between organizations, now you've got this lateral entry problem where you have to assume that somebody you're hiring from the outside has both the skills that they expect to be able to apply, but also be able to walk into all of this weird invisible work of the bureaucracy that the bureaucracy itself doesn't really want to advertise.
I mean, on that note, that's an interesting note, because in hiring nowadays, one is it's external quite often, which is what you brought up, Tom. But second is that external one is also likely to be lateral. So not necessarily you're hiring from below into a promoted position. And in that sense, I would imagine that facet of modern hiring, where it's lateral external, actually overcomes some of the Peter principle, because the Peter principle is reliant on the fact that you're hiring from below. And so what you can observe is them doing their job, but that's a different job from the one you want them for, as opposed to hiring someone where you can observe how they're doing in the job that you're hiring for directly. So that's an interesting thought about to what extent does that actually allow you to bring in people who are competent rather than hiring them at the risk of hiring them into a level of incompetence.
On the other hand, are we potentially bringing in somebody who's already achieved their level of incompetence but are doing a good job of masking it?
So people that study careers and mobility, they talk exactly about the limits of the portability of skills. And I think there is exactly some of that there are other types of challenges, which is exactly what you're saying, Tom. The context matters for the work to be performed, right? And the person that is hiring vertically, it's less of a concern because in principle, the person is aware of that. The routines of the organization, the technologies, the social ties, the trust, and so on, as in conditions in which there are lateral hires, in which there are hires of external people into a particular position, then the question is, of course, how to translate the skills in a particular setting to another setting, right? So it's a different kind of dimension of the question of competence that is brought forward.
And just to add on that, on a cynical note, hirings which are lateral of people who do well in that position elsewhere are also a way of just not really bothering or not sort of, you know, saving on training, let's put it that way, as in like the other organization has trained them to do well somehow. And I think there's something about the Peter principle in the entire volume that really a common thread, or one of the many common threads, is around learning and training. And I think it's an important one that maybe we can pick up later as well.
Oh, I'd like to go ahead and run with that one, because I think it is interesting. You know, I'm in an organization that values internal training. I'm working in a defense organization, and professional education is a big part of our experience, because the risk of getting it wrong, the risk of promoting people from within, because we really do have to rely on promoting heavily from within, the risk of having the wrong people in the higher locations is so great that we can't afford to have people promoted to their level of incompetence. And we need to retrain and we need to re-educate to ensure that they've got the skills. In the typical organization, you can, I haven't studied this, but I imagine that there's some sort of a sine wave between recognition that people have to invest in their own people for promotions until it gets too expensive, and then they start cutting budgets, and that's one of the things that gets cut. And we start then going down a low ebb of not investing the same way, and then we realize, oh, we can't afford to continue on this route because we keep getting people who are not able to adapt to the new environment, so then we have to reinvest. And it's sort of like a cycle of investing, not investing, et cetera. It does kind of get into to what extent does it become an individual's responsibility to retrain themselves versus an organization's responsibility or an organization's duty to ensure that they set up managers for success. If it was not a money issue, I'm sure the answer would be, you know, all of it. Everybody would be doing it.
Well, I don't know if they all would do it, because I think that some of what you're saying, and I recognize from, you know, literature and research on high reliability organizations, right? So any kind, or any organization that has very firm specific skills, right? But so you can think of a variety. I was thinking, of course, as complex manufacturing, safety related operations, right? We may see, and that's exactly where we see stuff, not just an investment in training, but also I was thinking about types of careers and lateral careers, right? The famous technical fellows from IBM, Boeing, and others, in which one can progress by specializing. I understand that to some extent professional service firms has been experimenting with specialized roles as well, right? So changing a little bit of the traditional upper out type of just one linear thing, but given complex in technology and so on, or different social expectations. Some of that has also emerged, right? The possibility of creating career paths that are not just vertical, and maybe recognize exactly that we should, especially in particular situations, it's particularly important to make sure people have particular skills to do particular tasks that can be, you know, if badly done, and catastrophic.
Yeah, what this conversation is making me think about is maybe one of the other reasons why the Peter Principle has been popular and enduring. And when I think about other media, maybe more contemporary, that it's covering kind of the same environment, the office environment, like Office Space, the movie, the television series, The Office, whether it's the UK or the US version. There's Dilbert, a famous comic strip series from very popular in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. I mean, the office environment itself, it just seems to be a very popular topic to lampoon. So I suppose, I don't know if it's necessarily that the Peter Principle initiated this, or if it was, if all of these media just simply play on a common thread of anxiety or whatever about the office environment or management. And I suppose it sort of raises a question about the role of satire as a way of sort of shining the light on phenomena that might otherwise not be all that interesting, or I don't know. It's those types of television shows, or you know, that type of media resonates because it just triggers a nerve. There's something in us we know is wrong, and it just it puts it up to ridicule, and we all get a really good laugh out of it. But as a means of scholarship, what do you all think?
So I mentioned that in the beginning as well, but I think that the satire allows us to point to things that in the culture are felt, but it's hard to directly address and articulate. And I think it's interesting that this principle has been taken up by researchers, right? There is all sorts of, especially by economists, that have to look exactly, you know, does the principle hold in different industries? What does it matter? There are different types of promotion criteria, right? So I think a great example of something that is widely perceived, or at least felt, that was, let's say, at least labeled and identified in a popular press book, but then was subjected to investigation by social science research, right? I think there is an interesting arc there on how humor in popular press can actually be able to spot things that then can be subject of investigation.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I think one benefit is simply putting you in that position or in those shoes, and so almost like a phenomenological benefit of whether it's The Office or Dilbert or this book. It's just closer to the lived experience of the people you're trying to learn about or study. But second is, I think like Pedro was saying, it helps to get across the point through a kind of veneer of parody, but a serious point. And I think what happens then is you're, like we alluded to earlier, this book, the arguments are made in a forceful way, kind of intentionally avoiding nuance. What happens then is that you can accept and then investigate. And so while reading this book, I'm just fully accepting. I'm taking in the whole concept, the whole idea. I'm almost like breathing it. As opposed to, let's say, he had presented the idea in a very caveated form with 5 exceptions per chapter and 3 boundary conditions or whatever, it seems to work better. Of course, the trick becomes then to make sure you don't just, you accept and then it sticks in your mind and you just see everything through that lens. The trick is to then investigate and feel free to knock the idea about a little bit. But the benefit of satire seems to be that you just take the idea in first without having to go through analytical kind of gymnastics immediately.
I think it also just connects to that basic point that human beings, you know, sort of don't really accept criticism openly or freely, let's put it that way. So in a parallel universe, rewriting this book along the lines of you are incompetent obviously would raise a series of defensive mechanisms and of trying to engage in that debate where, okay, I'm going to destroy your arguments because I do not accept that as a conclusion. And yeah, and the accusation of being incompetent is quite a sort of a strong one. So from a rhetorical perspective, the use of satire, the use of images, the use of vignettes, which are extreme to a certain extent, possibly is the way of communicating that message without having to go through those barriers of, oh, I'm going to have to now defend my position because I'm going to be attacked.
Yeah, thanks for all that. And what I think we should also bring up, because we've been focused on the satire launched at hierarchy and launched at management, that wasn't the only target of satire for this book. He was also satirizing, to an extent, academics and the study of such phenomena. And it's a little bit more subtle, but like, for example, when he's defending archaeology as a science, he's putting in some sometimes rather hilarious put-downs of conventional academia. And there was also a later chapter in which he actually ran through some of the counter arguments from existing philosophers, and he shot them down too. It was unceremonious. And I suspect it was tongue-in-cheek, because I think he even intentionally self-contradicted on a couple of occasions that, it's really an exception, but it's not an exception. This guy said something right, but he's wrong, because it doesn't go in the favor of archaeology. So in a way, the formal academic approach to things, I think, was also a target of the satire, which kind of I appreciated a lot, because it sort of felt like, yeah, it's, we're so busy trying to be accurate, we're not clear, is I think the somewhat of the message.
And so just to clarify that hierarchaeology, not archaeology, which we mentioned by mistake in a couple of previous statements. Yeah, I think it is, now that you bring my attention to it, Tom, I suddenly feel like I saw it all along, but I wasn't quite picking up on it. But correct, because in the first chapter itself, where he introduces the Peter Principle, there's kind of an exclamatory subsection called "A New Science!" exclamation mark. And he says, you know, having formulated the principle, I discovered that I had inadvertently founded a new science, hierarchaeology, the study of hierarchies. And then later on, when we're in the apparent exceptions chapter, he points out, like, other people might think, you know, because scientists also think of lay people versus us. And he said he has kind of satirized that as well, where he says other people might see these pseudo promotions as actual promotions. And I quote, "But the experienced hierarchaeologist will never be deceived." So there's definitely a lot of that. And it is tongue in cheek. Or as Dr. Peter himself puts it in an introduction, which again, I have in my version of the book, he says it's tongue in both cheeks. So he's fully intentionally doing this.
I think one thing he may be poking fun at is the tendency sometimes for researchers, regardless of what's already known, is when they find out something in one of their studies, they'll go ahead and declare it as something novel, and they'll attach some sort of a name to it, even though it's something that, if you look in another field, has already been discovered and already has a label attached to it. I guess I don't know to what extent that was prevalent in the 1960s, but I guess it was. I think that's kind of interesting, because it's sort of gets into some of the discussions going on nowadays about how a lot of our academic disciplines have become so diffuse, that a lot of them are retreading a lot of the same ground without recognizing that, you know, say what's being said over in this subfield is also being said over in this other subfield, or has already been said over in this other subfield, and that there doesn't seem to be a harmonization or a unification of what is it that that we really have learned. It's so diffuse, we don't even see what's going on in other disciplines. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, one way in which that plays itself out in this book and in this satire is the construction of jargon, right? So we've talked about hierarchaeology, but there's a lot more in this book, whether it's tabulology or let's say percussive sublimation. If I just say that phrase, the listener has no idea what I'm talking about. And for the listener, I'll direct you to chapter 3. I won't get into it now. But that was part of the intentional point. One, I feel like they do it in two ways. One is the jargon, and second is the degree to which they keep naming it. So it's not just Peter principle, but in between there's like Peter's inversion, Peter corollary, Peter this, Peter that. Somewhere I saw they had a Hull. Hull is one of the co-authors. So they had named something as the Hull argument as well. There's definitely some of that structure that gets constructed and then gets hard to speak across sciences is this level of terminology and jargon adding, as well as jargon land grabbing, I suppose, where you're just trying to name it for the sake of naming it.
Can I say my favorite? Hypercaninophobia complex. That was just it. Hypercaninophobia complex, top dog fear. This giving it this sort of like a psychiatric condition or a medical kind of language.
So there is a song I recently discovered that is called Acceptable in the 80s. And I think that this is making me think about what was acceptable or in the 60s. First of all, I was trying to think about what we said in part one and part two, the role of learning, right? And mentorship, the role of horizontal or lateral career paths and all of this kind of stuff that exists. And I was trying to think, we have to, I think, imagine that it was written in a time in which the large-scale enterprise, especially in the US, were becoming the form, right? Of course, it has started a bit earlier, but that is like a clear point, and that is also when organizational theory emerges because, you know, this specific type of social phenomena in society was becoming more prevalent, more clear, shaping and structuring people's lives in a particular way, right? So there's an effort to understand that. And I feel that some of the stuff that we, in the discussion, exists is exactly because it was to some extent new, right? To some extent. And to some extent that, you know, think of this was a world in which there were not as many MBA programs as we have today, right? The business schools were set up in a particular way that one would expect to get an MBA if you wanted to progress from a technical skill, say you're an engineer, to become a project manager in an engineering company, you know, get some training, project management, or whatever. This was not so prevalent, right? There is a particular time in which there's mastodontic organizations emerging, reshaping the way people think about their careers. There is not all of this set of compounded expectations about training, mentoring, HR, and all of the stuff that we know that try to smooth the process or the creation of business schools and all of the training towards management, which we saw is an important thing that seems to be missing in terms of the skills that accompany people in their progression in a typical vertical hierarchy. The other thing that I was thinking in terms of the time component was the value of competence, or we can say even more broadly, expertise, right? Because the other side, or maybe not the other side of the coin, but certainly a question that reading the book today raises is the extent in which there is still a cultural value about competence on what it means to do the work, how much we have trust in science, right? Who should staff which position? You know, who do you put in charge? And he talks a lot about government, right? Who do you staff in particular committees, right? And the role of politics, big P or small P politics into that. And I would justify certain appointments. So I think that the story has also become, on one extent, much more clean because you have systems and training and a whole education sector that tries to address some of this. But on the other, some of the underpinning cultural values may have shifted at the same time.
I would also advance that there's a conversation around gender minorities that progress that is missing because of the historical moment in which this is situated. I won't do the research and the studies no justice at all in being very sort of giving a broad sweep, but it's kind of mainstream knowledge that minorities, including females, to reach higher positions, they have had to show double competence, especially in, I hope not today, but I'm sure that there's still pockets of this today, in eras where it was difficult, let's put it that way. I think that's possibly the best way of summarizing. And obviously, this is a book in the 60s, things were advancing. it's also a book that is heavily dominated by male exams. I think there are perhaps a couple of female ones in the education space, but mostly male.
No, that's an excellent point. And we actually covered that in a recent episode, I want to say 99. I'll get the episode right. It raises a question that we have been leaning towards bureaucratizing or systematizing approaches to correct what has been a developmental issue. The more that we go down this path, which I think that we're seeing in this book and we're seeing in contemporary experiences, it still takes people. Like, this is really a people problem. It's not something that a system or a bureaucracy can solve on its own. And the point about women, minorities, is very well taken, because one of the reasons why we've systematized so much the way that we handle promotions and things of that nature is to try to be or try to improve fairness and equality of opportunity, one that was not so present when this book was written. But we also run into a conundrum that it's still also, selecting the right people is ultimately a people business. And if you build the system such that it is inflexible, you're going to end up with still promoting incapable or the wrong people into higher positions. It's a conundrum that I don't know that there's really a solution. It's an ever-present tension. But the more that we systematize, the more it seems like the people side of the equation becomes that much more. Especially if we're dealing with, we announce a job position that gets millions of applicants and trying to find that right one, why wouldn't it be better to just simply say, part of your job as a manager is to pick your own successor from within and make sure that they're ready to take the job, which is kind of going back to the future, but hopefully not going back to the bad ways.
Also on this broader point of the the 60s versus now and the changed work culture, let's say, and organizational culture, it then becomes interesting to ask, in a world where, let's say, there's much more learning, growth, even portfolio careers, even for people within organizations, rather than trying to move up a hierarchy, what would the answer to the research question of why incompetence be? And hence, I have coined the Rohin principle, which is that in a world of learning, growth mindset, and kind of portfolio careers, workers will spread themselves thin to the level of their incompetence. And that actually, the solution to that, by the way, is provided by Dr. Peter himself in the introduction to the book, in the version I have, where he says, quit while you are behind. And he says he did that when this book became famous and he started getting lots of kind of talk requests from companies and consulting projects from companies, and he decided to quit while he was behind.
I suppose what we could do with this episode is solicit on LinkedIn. Okay, what principle would you add? See what responses we get.
Yeah. Also, if y'all wanted to talk about any of the later chapters, one thing I do want to come back to in the end is because, again, in this introduction that I have of Dr. Peter, and that introduction is just from a year later, it's from 1970. He does talk about, like, he has a bit more of a moral prescription where he's like, you shouldn't even be trying to move up in life, which is implicit throughout the book. But like, I could quote from that in terms of like the bigger issue with all of this and his kind of view, because he also ties it into how the whole world is and how we're kind of heading towards all of these kind of rapid technological stuff without figuring out full kind of competence, or like working our way towards our incompetence as humanity, which maybe AI is a good example of. But yeah,
sorry, I was just thinking about AI. I was looking a little bit at the pictures and I hadn't really made the connection, but they're very reminiscent of those satire works of 1700s, like the Enlightenment. I don't know exactly references, but it feels like an art style that belongs to a couple of centuries ago. And it feels like it belongs to one of those pamphlet kind of type books that got kind of larger philosophical principles. I mean, it would be something to ask the authors if we could, but I thought it was perhaps a purposeful choice in terms of how to give it, I don't know, a framing or an authority. I think that's possibly where we're going.
One more thing I wanted to add, especially kind of towards the end here, is we've been talking about the ethos of capitalism and of kind of this idea of more is better and moving up and up and up is the goal. And in an introduction to the book that Dr. Peter wrote a year after, so it's still from the time in some sense, it's from 1970, he gets into what his own view of whether this is good or bad, and kind of spoiler alert, he thinks it's bad. And he ties it more broadly to not just, let's say, at the individual level, it's bad to always be wanting more and more and up, but also at the level of humanity, whether it's, and it was surprising to me, but in the 1970 version, he talks about ecological damage that we're doing to the world, etc., through this constant kind of trying to produce more and more, increase GDP more and more, etc. And so just a quick, a short quote from there where he says, "True progress is achieved through moving forward to a better way of life rather than upward to total life incompetence. Man must realize that improvement of the quality of experience is more important than the acquisition of useless artifacts and material possessions." So he makes his own kind of stance clear there, where his point is, look, everything I'm talking about in the book is how things work, and these tactics are how, if you want to kind of move up and play the game, this is how it works. But you must realize that this isn't even something to strive for necessarily.
Thanks for providing that, because that applies to the contemporary environment as well, because it really hasn't changed that much in 50 years, has it? I mean, and I think that's why the book kind of resonates. And now we're talking about some of the same things. Yeah, 1970 was when I remember ecology becoming a watchword, a big discussion point throughout the 1970s. What are we doing to the environment? And here we are back again in the 2020s in the same way. But I guess the question kind of is, why are we unable to break what is pretty much now a very, very set, established pattern of how we measure our worth, or how we consider individual or collective progress, which is, I guess, is seen as up as opposed to forward. I'm not even sure I could answer the question, what do we mean by forward other than up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sense I get from the Dr. Peter, this perspective is, forward means towards deeper meaning or higher quality, which we do know, at least from kind of research on things like choice and how to, beyond a certain point, too much choice, or things like happiness and income. And again, there's threshold effects there, as well as more neurochemical understanding of things like the dopamine and other neurotransmitters. We do know that more is not always better, and that things like pause, rest, etc., actually lead to more quality overall. And so the sense I get from what his meaning of forward is, it's towards, for example, focusing on quality versus quantity.
The first thing that came to my mind on this distinction was that forward would be something that you go collectively, right? Versus the up is, and it's something that you construct, versus upward, which is basically just trying to fill up existing structure. I mean, it's a very tainted word today, but it's progress, but we may call it development, we may call evolving, growth. I mean, these are all loaded terms, but I'm trying to say is that something that is done together and is done with a sense of purpose. And the book pokes fun at that, right? Trying to just takes for granted the existing system, just get ahead no matter what, and looks what it leads to you, you know, where it puts you, and potentially also where it puts us collectively.
What came to my mind instead was, you know, those stories about actors and how at the beginning they took on jobs which were very maybe sort of menial, maybe not really what they wanted, but it was because that job would have served the greater purpose of then progressing to what was, in a forward sense, what they truly wanted to do. So to a certain extent, planning your professional life with that idea of what is the real career that I want to do, I thought that was where that part of the Peter Principle contribution spoke to, or at least that's my interpretation.
Yeah, but you know, one phenomenon that's very definitely contemporary that didn't really exist in Peter's time, you know, or at the time of this book, is the notion that you could actually start at the top from nowhere. And what I'm thinking of is like social media influencers or some of these others where young people start, you know, as opposed to where we all start off at the entry level, or we're all accustomed coming from the background of starting at an entry level and this notion of working your way up. There's, you know, whole classes of people who are now essentially starting from a rather high position or a high status. I am my own brand. I have a YouTube channel that I am producing, and I've got sponsors, and I have all of this stuff. The hierarchy is, I'm not saying there's no hierarchy. What I mean is that it's vastly different, such that you may achieve final placement syndrome very early in your working life. And then what? What happens to the YouTuber who falls out of favor after a couple of years because don't have new content? And then what? There is almost like a expectation that we have to have reinventing ourselves as a natural or as an important life skill, because we're going to almost be expected to go at things by winning the lottery and then let it peter out and then move on to a whole different episode or something like that to reinvent ourselves. I don't know to what extent that that's widespread, but when I think about still this notion that there's a large population of young people who put down, I want to be a social media influencer as their number one aspiration, that itself reflects a whole change in the meaning of what is understood to be work, hierarchy, moving up, all of this. Does that make sense?
Three quick things. It makes sense. And I think it reveals exactly what is the cultural values we live today. But this expectation to reinvent ourselves made me think of the Madonna principle, which could be something like, instead of, you know, expecting people to compare you to your previous album or performance, you just move sideways. So this way, you know, you're just like in a new thing, so you don't have to suffer the critique and the comparison to your previous one. But what I really wanted to say is, yes, to some extent, this whole thing about TikTokers and influencers feels new, but nobility has ever existed, right? And it was even more salient and prevalent part of culture and, you know, in some places and in certain times, a whole division by caste has always pervaded the way in which people work, or in this case, don't need to work for a living, right? So it is new to expect in the system we exist today, which is not so far from the 60s, that one can have the expectation to start at the top by basically starting as a complete independent entrepreneur. And there are some cases, but has always existed people that by being born part of something and don't have to even think about the hierarchy in such terms because they're already at the top, right? And to some extent, some entrepreneur careers has always existed, right? So of course, as social media just shapes the discourse and then does shapes expectations and shapes the way we think about hierarchy. And if hierarchy maybe had a bad reputation from this book and this time, has certainly a worst one nowadays, right? So that is certainly a cultural shift.
I think another key element of what is the right way or what ought to be for these authors, for Dr. Peter, let's say, given that timing of the book, the 60s, 70s, is that some of the up and up and more ethos was manifest in the Cold War. And so, you know, 60s was the space race between the US and Soviet Union. We had gone from atomic fission bombs to fusion bombs. And so part of it was also that, I think, informing this more moral suggestion that I quoted from earlier, where he says, you know, that what we need to look for is something different. Because later, I think at some point, Pedro, you were, or Tom, we were talking about what does forward look like? What does progress look like? He says, and I quote, man must, and again, like Miranda said, he uses the male gendered terminology throughout, man must reassess the meaning of life and decide whether he will use his intellect and technology for the preservation of the human race and the development of the humanistic characteristics of man, or whether he will continue to utilize his creative potential in escalating a super colossal death trap. And so this was from the time being, again, escalating war, which we find ourselves back in that kind of potential conflict situation, escalating technological races in today's world that might be AI. The suggestion was to avoid the Peter Principle, not by kind of stepping out of the game, but by changing the value system towards one of more humanistic values and reassessing meaning in life at a species level, I suppose.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.